From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Whether it's repairing defects, growing tissue, or customizing cell patterns, the future of regenerative medicine may lie in 3D printing. Professor John P. Fisher, who chairs the University of Maryland's Fischel Department of Bioengineering and directs the new Center for Engineering Complex Tissue there, describes the potential of this new technology.
We can build up these large objects, we can have a living cell population within them, and the real promise of printing and bioprinting is we can do this in a very precise, almost architectural way.
And bioengineer fellow Laurie Bacaglia describes her work using the thin tissue that surrounds the heart, pericardial tissue, as a graft material, as well as making printable bio-ink from it. 3D printing and regenerative medicine on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. You may be familiar with 3D printing. A computer follows a blueprint and lays down layers and layers of material to build something. But what if instead of using plastic or nylon, the printer used human cells for those layers? And instead of creating objects, you could use this technology to create a liver or bone. Whether it's repairing defects, growing tissue, or customizing cell patterns, 3D printing is opening doors in the field of regenerative medicine. Joining me to talk about the promise of bioprinting is Professor John P. Fisher, chair of the University of Maryland Fischel Department of Bioengineering. Welcome to On the Record.
It's wonderful to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Give us your definition of 3D bioprinting.
Most people are familiar with 3D printing, as you described, where you use typically an extrusion method to layer things upon one layer upon another to build a three-dimensional object. Here we're doing something very similar, but in that material we're also embedding a cell population, typically a stem cell population. So we're extruding material that's similar to Jell-O and that it has a large water content, and within that Jell-O-like material we can put in cells. We often use stem cells or adult stem cells, mesenchymal stem cells, or other cell populations. So we can build up these large objects, we can have a living cell population within them, and the real promise of printing and bioprinting is we can do this in a very precise, almost architectural way. So we can put things where we want them, we can put specific cell types where we want them, we can put multiple cell types together in different patterns to build a construct that we're particularly interested in, either exploring as a model or hopefully eventually using as a regenerative tissue that we can implant into patients.
So you're describing a material component and a biological component. What types of cells are used for the biological component?
Most often, we work with mesenchymal stem cells. So these are stem cells that are typically obtained from one's bone marrow, but you can also get them from other tissues. Fat is a very common source as well. These cells have the ability to differentiate or essentially become specialized into any of the connective tissues. So think of things like bone, cartilage, muscle, tendon, ligament. And given the right signals, the right directions, these cells differentiate or they become cells that live in these adult tissues and function as the cells in those adult tissues.
And the material component is made of what?
You can use materials where the cell population lives on the material, or you can use materials where the cell population lives within the material. If you're growing cells on things, you have a big range of materials you can use. It can be anything from plastics that are similar to the material that degradable sutures are made out of. That's called PLGA, polylactic coglycolic acid, or derivatives of those polymers. Now, if you want to take a cell population, you want to grow it in the material, then you need that material to have a large water content, just like our body does, just like our tissue has a large water content that allows for nutrients and oxygen to get to the cells, to feed the cells, and also allows for waste products and carbon dioxide to get away from the cells. So you need something that has a large water content. So there you typically use a class of materials that's called hydrogels. And the hydro refers to the large water content. And these can be contents up to 90, 95, 99 weight percent of the material mass. And the easiest example is, like I was saying earlier, something like Jell-O. So Jell-O is made from collagen, and you can use materials that are collagen-based or other polymers that like to live and like to exist next to water.
So earlier, if I was thinking that the structure needed to be rigid, I was wrong. The structure can be...
Well, certainly if you were going to make something like bone, you would need something quite strong. So there you would either use a two-material approach, one material that's providing the mechanical strength and another material that's providing the environment to keep the cells happy. Or you would maybe start out with a material that doesn't have the mechanical strength of bone. But the cells themselves make a matrix that can become mineralized and they can become stronger while you're growing it in the lab that could potentially reach some of the strengths of bone tissue.
And are we usually more often than not talking about a structure that will, as the example you gave, of one that will decompose in the body, that will disappear in the body? Is that essentially what you're trying to make?
Absolutely. So the materials that we're using are typically described as biodegradable or bioresorbable. So typically by the action of water, the material breaks down, and it breaks down in components that your body can take up and either use in normal metabolism or it can excrete. So the one material, and I think what material that many people are familiar with, is degradable sutures material, PLGA, that I referred to earlier. It breaks down into lactic acid, and lactic acid is one of the components of metabolism, of anaerobic metabolism. So your body can use that for other things as well.
That's Professor John Fisher, chair of the University of Maryland Fischel Department of Bioengineering. Here on The Record on WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. Fisher is director of the new Center for Engineering Complex Tissues. It's received $6.25 million in funds from NIH. We're talking about using 3D printing technology to print human cells. I mentioned growing a new liver, or building bones. What other purposes could bioprinting have?
So I think that's really the long-term goal, is to try to build replacement tissues to deal with this large need we have for organ replacement or tissue replacement. But there's a lot of series of steps we can take to get to that ultimate goal. So one simple step is making models of tissues. So if we're creating, let's say, a new cancer therapeutic and you want to test that therapeutic, you could test that on an engineered tissue, on a bioprinted tissue that you have a lot of control with in the lab, and use that as an intermediate test as you're developing that drug. If you want to see how different cell populations work together or how drugs affect multiple cell populations, you could build these models and look at and investigate those questions. There's another step that we could also take. We could make engineer tissues for companion animals. So for your dogs and cats and horses that we work with and love and play with every day, that's an intermediate step that we can get to before we get to the final human application, because the human application has a lot of challenges, and everyone's always thinking about the regulatory hurdles we need to address if we want to get it ultimately approved by FDA so it can be used in a clinical setting.
What humans do you see benefiting most from this technique ultimately?
Certainly patients that have had some kind of acute either traumatic event or a cancerous tumor where they remove that tissue and the surrounding tissue. I think those are some of the clear indications. But there are other applications, as we were talking about as well, that could affect a broader population, even just helping us understand biology a little bit better. We have a project in collaboration with Children's National Medical Center down in D.C. where we're building models of the placenta that allows us to ask questions that surround preeclampsia. So there we're not trying to engineer a placenta to implant in the body, but we're creating a cell-based construct that allows us to look at some of the development of preeclampsia and how that might be treated with drugs in the future.
Which you can't usually do because it's dangerous to a mother and fetus to actually study a placenta.
Absolutely. It would be almost impossible to do that in humans. And there are also very, very few, if any, good animal models of human preeclampsia.
So why is this better than current methods of regenerative medicine?
So I think the beauty of printing and bioprinting is the ability to control things in terms of position and location and orientation at a very high spatial resolution. So typical printing approaches, now this is 3D printing, might get down to about 20 or so microns. Bioprinting is maybe a little bit higher in terms of resolution, maybe up to 50 or 100 microns. But at that level of precision, we can place a single cell population and a second cell population next to it and ask questions about how they interact with one another. If we want to start thinking about how do we build vasculature to support surrounding tissue. So if we could, and folks have established pretty robust ways to engineer something that looks like and functions a little bit like a bone tissue. If we were to implant that in the body, we need some way to deliver nutrients. We need some way to deliver oxygen to that bony tissue. Your body uses your circulatory system, you know, your arteries and veins. But we need to build something like that in our engineered tissues. And bioprinting allows you the way to start thinking about ways that you could create an artificial vasculature. So when you implant this tissue into the body, it can act like your normal tissue.
Some of our listeners may have thought when they heard about using human cells to build other cells that you can use a person's own cells.
Absolutely.
If you're going to grow an organ for them. So you minimize the risk of rejection?
You minimize the risk of rejection. Some of the moral and ethical concerns that folks have had for a number of years, those are also eliminated as well. So the ability to take an adult cell population from your own tissue and use that and grow that and deliver it back to the patient is really is a wonderful approach. There are challenges, though, with that approach, because if you're in a car accident and you need a new chunk of femur bone tissue to replace your femur, if we come to you and say, yes, give us your cells, we're going to go back to them and work with them in the lab for 4, 6, or 8 weeks and then come back to you, that may not be a very good approach. So hand in hand, while we think about autologous cell
transplantation. I don't know what autologous means.
So autologous means that the cells are coming from you. We can also think about using donor cells from other people, where maybe these cells can be delivered to a second person without causing a big rejection concern.
This spring, the University of Maryland announced it will lead the Center for Engineering Complex Tissues, funded by the National Institutes of Health, Rice University in Texas, and North Carolina's Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine are partners of the center, and you are its director. What are its goals?
So the center is a wonderful concept that was established by NIH a number of years ago. So these are called BTRCs, Biomedical Technology Resource Centers. And the idea is that you put together a group of investigators that are developing technologies, and in our case, printing and bioprinting. And we're going to use the center as a way to disseminate these technologies to the surrounding community throughout the nation and internationally. So really, the center is creating technologies and allowing other investigators, they may come to us and say, can you build this object for us, or can you help us print this this material or work with these cells. And we work with them in a very collaborative fashion and kind of grow the community that uses, in this case, printing and bioprinting approaches. So it's a five-year commitment by NIH. It's tremendous. We're very, very excited to be leading this endeavor. And we really, truly hope to see that the center grows the community and the number of investigators that are working in the field.
We need to take a quick break here on the record. Professor John Fisher is with us, and when we come back, from heart defects to ruptures, how 3D bioprinting can repair the heart. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. The future of surgery, skin grafts, and organ donation is ripe with potential as technology advances. From muscles and tendons to ligaments and even organs, we're looking at how 3D printing of human cells could transform the field of regenerative medicine. I'm speaking with Professor John P. Fisher, Chair of the University of Maryland Fischel Department of Bioengineering and Director of the new Center for Engineering Complex Tissues. Joining us now is bioengineer Laura Bracaglia. She conducted research at the University of Maryland on bioprinting pericardial tissue, the thin tissue that surrounds the heart, as well as making a printable form of bioink. She's now a postdoctoral fellow at Yale University. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks. Hi. Nice to be here.
Laura Bracaglia, tell us about your research.
Okay. I just finished my thesis work at the University of Maryland, and the majority of my work was focused on the development of a hybrid biomaterial. That's a combination of a naturally derived material from the body. In my work, I'm using pericardium, combined with a synthetic or man-made polymer. The specific combination that I developed for use on our bioprinters is a combination of homogenized or ground-up pericardium tissue with the biocompatible polymer PEG or polyethylene glycol.
Do I know polyethylene glycol in some other setting?
Yes. It's really commonly used in a lot of implanted material. It's
PEG, you can find it as a drug additive. You can find it in your shampoo. It's a material that really loves.
I think that's where I've seen the phrase. I thought I might know that phrase. But ground up pericardial tissue.
Yeah.
Describe that process.
Yes, sure. It's actually a procedure or a protocol, I guess, that has a lot of popularity. We take tissue. Ours is xenographic or from animals, so animal pericardium. You remove the cellular component using detergents so that you kind of remove the identity of the tissue. It can help with rejection issues. We remove the cells, and we're left with just collagen and other structural proteins like elastin and fibrin. So we take those proteins that are left behind and mechanically grind them and then enzymatically digest them further, so we're left with just the individual molecules in a water-based solution.
And you don't need to start with human pericardial tissue.
No, there's actually a lot of similarities between animal pericardium and vascular tissue compared to human vascular tissue. So the building blocks, the protein components are very similar.
So what kind of treatments could this type of 3D bioprinting replace?
The specific application of my thesis work is for vascular graft applications.
So what does that mean?
If you have a vascular disease, like a blocked artery, or perhaps like a rupture or an aneurysm in the artery, and you need to replace that piece of vessel with a prosthetic, right now choices are metal or biofelt grafts or replacements for that.
Biofelt, like material of some sort.
Mm-hmm. A synthetic material, yeah. That would not degrade, but would be kind of your replacement blood vessel.
Uh-huh.
There's also other options in terms of chemically cross-linked animal tissue, but all of those choices are permanent implants. So the goal of tissue-engineered vascular grafts is to build vascular replacements that are only temporary, that your body can the native cells in your body can move into and remodel. And then eventually the graft that we implant degrades away and you're left with a self-maintained vascular wall.
And the advantage of that is that phrase you use, self-maintained, mm-hmm. it implies to me that it will
grow with you.
It will grow with you. I didn't mm-hmm. even think of that, but it will kind of repair itself as
yeah.
you go along. It won't
exactly.
need as much external attention.
Yes. A lot of the challenges with the permanent vascular implants are that they can create or accumulate calcium deposits over time or become stiff and kind of lose their mechanical integrity, and they need to be replaced. So if, as an alternative, if you use a tissue-engineered approach and you have a self-maintained vascular wall, you reduce the need for future surgical interventions.
And is that its primary advantage over what we do now?
Yes, I think so. That seems to have the most application in terms of older patients as well as pediatric patients. But then with pediatric patients, you have the benefit I mentioned earlier that the graft can grow with a child.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Professor John Fisher, chair of the University of Maryland Fischel Department of Bioengineering and director of the new Center for Engineering Complex Tissues, and bioengineer Laura Bracaglia, who's conducted research on bioprinting heart tissue. Laurie, how long does it take to 3D print parts of a heart?
Well, it's pretty dependent on the material that you choose and the size of the tissue replacement that you want to create. In my particular research, like I mentioned, I'm using a hybrid bioink, so combining the pericardium building blocks with a man-made polymer in a hydrogel bioink to print an entire pediatric aortic arch, so a pretty big portion, the main vessel that leaves the heart and delivers blood to the next three main arteries. It's about maybe like 5 to 10 centimeters tall. That took about 12 hours.
Oh, it's a significant amount of time. John, is the amount of time required to print a potential downside to this technology?
Yeah, so the printing the Laurie was describing is a light-based printing, and it can definitely take some time because you're building things layer by layer, but each layer is so small that if you want to make anything of any significant size, like the aortic arch, when you do it all together, it takes some time. The approach the Laurie was using is an acellular approach, so there isn't a cell population in it. You would add the cell population secondarily to building it, so you don't have to worry about that. If you were printing cells within the material, then you would absolutely need to do something much more quickly, a different printing approach or a different printing material where you're printing in the order of minutes so that you can get the cell population back into a culture environment where it's happy and healthy and can live and do its normal function.
John, how far is this technology, everything we've been talking about, from being used in human patients?
So I think tissue engineering or regenerative medicine is pushing things every day. One of our collaborators, Tony Atala, down at Wake Forest, is already well on the way of multi-year clinical applications for engineered bladders and other reproductive and urinary tissues. Those are in patients now today. FDA recently, I believe it was in December, approved a cell-based engineered cartilage therapy. And I believe that's one of the very, very first FDA-approved cell-based using a matrix. In that case, they're using a porcine or pig-derived matrix for cartilage engineering. So there's absolutely realities today, but I think the field recognizes that there's been a lot of discussion and a lot of almost hype about what we're doing, and everyone's trying to make sure that we have clinical successes on a regular basis so that we can keep the community and keep the field moving forward.
Laurie, what excites you about this technology?
I think it's the ability, like Dr. Fisher mentioned, the structural and like architectural control that 3D printing gives you to create a very specific scaffold or vascular graft in my research. The fact that we can get that structural and architectural control from a biological material is pretty exciting. I think biological materials, like as I described, derived from animal tissue in my case or from other human tissue, seem to have the best, or I guess in my opinion, are a really strong tool to use for tissue engineered scaffolds. And if we can use that material in a 3D printer, then we kind of combine the best of both, the biological relevancy and the structural control from a printer.
And if I may just add, Lori's work is really critical because we don't really have that many materials that we can print, biologically relevant materials that work well with cell populations. So you think of all the materials that are out there, then the printable materials, and then the printable materials that are good for biological applications. You get down to just a handful of materials. So coming up with new materials that work well in a biological environment is very, very critical. And that's something the field is also trying to do in a concerted effort.
What are the next steps, John, in getting the Center for Engineering Complex Tissues off the ground?
So we're hiring our assistant director. We're forming the infrastructure right now. The grant was awarded early this spring and in April. We've had our initial kickoff meetings a week or two ago. The center also has educational and training components with it, one of which was a workshop that was held down at Wake Forest 2 weeks ago, and a second of which will be held at Rice in the second week of August. So we have a lot of mechanisms in place, but I still have more work to do to put things together and get things moving.
Well, good luck to both of you as you continue this. It's really exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Professor John P. Fisher chairs the University of Maryland Fischel Department of Bioengineering and directs the new Center for Engineering Complex Tissues. Laura Bracaglia was a postdoctoral fellow in the bioengineering department at the University of Maryland. She's continuing her research at Yale University. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.